Good afternoon. It is a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful day today in Oregon. It's May 3rd, 2017. I'm opening the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Public Safety. It's a public hearing on House Bill 5004, the Department of Corrections. And with that, would Director Colette Peters and Steve Robbins please?
Madam Chair, may I just start comment?
Not yet, please. I believe that Co-Chair Stark is just anxious and eager to make a comment.
Well, comment is, I very much look forward to your presentation. However, I have to go testify on a constituent bill, and I hope I'll be back quickly.
He shall return quickly.
Thank you, Co-Chair Stark. Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, I am Colette Peters, the director of the Oregon Department of Corrections, and we are really pleased to be back before you for our Phase 2 budget presentation. It is beautiful outside. Most of you probably haven't been out of the building, having just driven from headquarters over. I'm very grateful that you're all here and not playing hooky, so thank you. Today we are going to start off with our Chief Financial Officer, Steve Robbins. Mr. Robbins has been with the Department of Corrections since 2009. He has a very unique history. I always tell him he needs to write a book given all of the positions that he's held. But at DOC, he spent time both in the Planning and Budget Office and the Operations Division in the Health Services role. Prior to his appointment as CFO, he served as our Health Services Administrator. And some of you will remember his leadership in 2014 during Senate Bill 843, our Correctional Health Care Cost Work Group. Before joining DOC, Mr. Robbins spent 19 years in the private sector, both as the owner of a project management firm and as an executive manager overseeing North American inbound logistics on contract to the Ford Motor Company. And I share all of that with you today just because I think the state of Oregon is very fortunate to have someone with his experience in the role at the Department of Corrections, and I'm pleased to have him at my side today. So while you'll hear from me about halfway through this presentation, I will now turn it over to Mr. Robbins.
All right. Thank you, Director. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Robbins. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Oregon Department of Corrections. And today I'd like to take some time to sort of walk you down a path, first starting with this biennium, talking about where we are in terms of our biennium to date now, and then move into 17-19 and talk a little bit about where our budget stands and the investment that's currently in our governor's balanced budget as we move forward. If we were to go back to the 2015 session, at the end of session, the Department of Corrections received a $15 million undesignated reduction to our budget at that point in time. And in the Senate Bill 5504 budget report, it referred to it as a vacancy savings target. And one of the things I think you've heard us talk about is that a vast majority of our budget is in personal services in the Department of Corrections, and a big chunk of that falls in our operations, security, and health services components. And those are all portions of our agency that stand posts. Those are 24/7 posts every day of the year. So vacancy savings is a real struggle for us when we try to hit those kinds of targets. But that aside, we wanted to talk about some of the administrative restrictions that we put in place around the agency and where we are right now in terms of meeting some of those actions. Some of the things that we've seen happening across the state right now in terms of hiring freeze, prior to that was a 60-day hold on positions. The Department of Corrections actually has been doing that since almost the beginning of the biennium. So some of the things we're seeing go across the whole state right now are things that in DOC we've actually been working on for, 20 months or more at this point. When you look at travel restrictions, our holding off on maintenance, our attempt to hold positions vacant where we can really be a struggle also because of the posts we have to incur overtime just to cover those posts. So all of those things combined net to about $4.3 million in savings so far this biennium that we've been able to achieve there. We've also put in place, because we knew that this biennium we were going to need to save, as well as next biennium, we knew what was coming. We've made some reductions in programming that we talked about in the initial Ways and Means presentation that we did. We also, when you look at our inmate work programs, We do have a little bit of margin in that business model. So as we bring in other funds revenue, we hopefully cover our costs, plus we have a little bit of money that's left over. What we did in this case, as we do in every biennium, is we scour the general fund side of our ledger to see if there's anything that can appropriately be applied over there to that other fund side. And so we went ahead and made those adjustments as well, to the tune of about $1.5 million. Last on this list, if you look at all of our trailers that are traveling around, our truck trailers and our inventory control systems and everything, we have about $6 million in inventory and food and things like that all across the state. We always try to draw that inventory level down over the course of the biennium, and our goal right now is to exceed what we typically draw down by about $500,000 to save on general fund side there as well. Now, with all of those things in place, just a few weeks ago, Senate Bill 5508 passed, which provided us $6 million in general fund backfill for our current deficit. And so as we move forward right now, we're projecting a deficit for this biennium right around $2.2 million. Now, the one thing I would ask all of us to remember is that that can be a very fluid number. If you look across the Department of Corrections, most of the things that we project are fairly stable. Our staffing is fairly stable, food costs, utility costs, they shift up and down a little, but they're fairly stable. The one element of our budget that is not stable is healthcare. If there's one person that comes into the network who needs a bone marrow transplant, somebody comes in with leukemia, we've been talking for years about hepatitis C and the potential costs there, and new drugs coming on the market all the time. This is a number that can change very quickly and very dramatically. So we're cautiously optimistic right now, but we're keeping our eye on that healthcare side, because that could double this number very easily in just a couple of months. So before we get into the governor's budget and where we are, I'd like to talk very briefly about current service level. As you know, our base budget starts from this biennium moving forward, and that base budget for us was $1.683 billion. When you look at the essential packages that were added to that, which were the inflation issues, caseload, phase-ins, adjustments, all that came to about $89.5 million. And so in total, our current service level for 17-19 was $1.772 billion. Now, I like to call out the fact that that is our all-funds budget. General fund is $1.725 billion. So we only say that to just share that, as you know, our budget is almost exclusively general fund. We have a little bit of other fund and almost no federal funds in our budget. This slide, we just wanted to provide you an opportunity to see how we break this budget out across all the various divisions that we have. Again, I'd call out the first two lines, operations and healthcare. That's where 65% of our budget is. It's where 85% of our positions are in the agency. So a lot of numbers and a lot of small words on this slide. I apologize for that, but we did want to just give you something in this presentation packet that coalesced everything into one slide. And really all this does is talk about at the very top level, our base budget, where the essential packages came in. The next few slides I'm going to talk about are the policy option packages that did receive some investment in the governor's budget, and then the ones down below are the other types of reductions that currently exist in our budget. So when we talk about the policy option packages that we requested, these are the ones I'm going to talk about now are the ones where the governor did make targeted investments in these areas. The first one was a programmatic backfill of $3 million in general fund. When we actually built our budget going into the agency request component, we thought we were going to be losing $7 million of revenue due to the telephone contract, the inmate communications contract. Due to a number of issues and how that's being procured and whatnot, it turns out that we're going to be able to retain that revenue through this biennium. So we're anticipating that this $3 million that was targeted in the governor's budget probably won't be there as we move forward, but we just wanted to call it out. The next three items, I'm going to have an individual slide for each of them, so I won't cover them now, but just to say that all of our capital investment is bond related, so it's all other funds. The second bullet point here are those investments that were made during this biennium that we are carrying forward. As you know, we received funding to not only shift the population at Deer Ridge and Madras from the minimum facility over to the medium, but we also expanded by 200 beds there. What this does is it simply codifies that in the new budget and covers the staffing as we move forward. The same exact situation for the behavioral health unit at the penitentiary. We've got initial investment that was occurring this time, but a bulk of what's happening there is really coming on board here in the next few months and as we move into the next biennium. Last but not least, the OSPM is reactivated in the governor's budget, and the director will be talking a little bit more about OSPM as we move forward. So the first thing I'd like to talk about in terms of capital investment is our inmate commissary and banking system, also called the TAG system. Really, this is a very outdated system for us, and it's a little scary at how unstable it is. We actually have components of this program that are running on Windows XP on old computers that sit standalone because the network folks don't want the computer to even touch anything else in our network. We also have situations where our printers are so old that the drivers don't work, and we have staff members taping magnets to printer cartridges to get them to work. So this is a system, it's $500,000 to get it updated, and this is a system that we really need moving forward. Now, there's an additional element to this, and that is that this is the system that will bear the brunt of...
Senator Fredericks, please.
Oh, yeah.
How did we... I worked with the Portland schools for a while, and we had a problem because we had a system where we were running COBOL 72. On the system up until about 2003, which made no sense to anyone because in order to get anything, any software done, we had to find retirees who could still code in COBOL 72. How do we reach this particular point where we are dealing with XP and we're dealing with printers and the like? Is it just the deferred maintenance situation, or just what allowed us to do that? This is on the order of riding along on very bald tires that you know would be immediately punctured by something on the just a regular roadway. What's the deal? Why do we have this?
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Frederick, I'm happy to answer that question. You can chime in with more detail if you haven't, Mr. Robbins. So the Windows XP is actually shinier and more lovely than our actual major system for the criminal justice system. So the entire criminal justice system in Oregon relies on CJIS, which is COBOL-based. And so I used to be able to joke that I had one individual who could still program it and was retirement eligible but was still with us, and that person is no longer with us. And so it has been just an inability of funds. I remember when I first came to the department in 2004, replacing our CIS program was a policy option package even back then. So it's something that we've asked for, and the monies just have not been available. So this one is a much smaller replacement than our entire CIS system, which is why I think we were able to secure some funds to get this process and this going.
Yeah, Co-Chair Winters, Senator Frederick, the other thing too, it is a matter of prioritization for us. We've actually been able to get a hold of some of this equipment using eBay and things like that, where there are other systems where we can't even do that. So it is it has not been ideal, but we're excited about the possibility of upgrading this system to get at least this one stable.
Follow up. If we can, is there a way for you to put together what you really need? Not what you can possibly get, but what you really need. What would a system that was effective look like is what I'm curious about. And I know it's going to cost money. We know that. That's a guarantee. But the patchwork kind of approach doesn't work either. And if there's a way for us to have something like that, I would like to see that. I'm not asking for it right away. Sure. But this is something I'd like to see, and I think it needs to go into the IT committee so that they're looking at these kinds of things as well. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
I'll just say, did it all my colleagues said, but ask a different question. The $2.2 million that you were talking about being short, and you alluded to the fact that, you know, one expected very expensive medical case can throw your whole budget out of whack. How much of that do you think is attributable to health care costs, that deficit that you're talking about right now? Or is it that impossible to calculate?
Yeah, Co-Chair Winters, Senator Steiner Hayward, it's very difficult. If you look at our health services budget overall, we're actually under budget in the health side of the business.
Okay.
It's just that when you take a $1.7 or $1.8 billion budget and we're talking about margins of just a $2
million, right.
Very small fractions of a percentage can change that.
Follow-up.
Thank you. So where do you guys stand on the whole Hep C issue at this point? How many of your inmates do you think are infected, and how many, what are you doing about treatment, and how's that working out? Because this is a huge issue that we're facing over in the other sub that I live with day in and day out. So,
Co-Chair Winters, Senator Steiner Hayward, I can tell you some specific numbers right now as of today. If we don't know, as an agency, we do not require Hep C testing. It's optional, and so that's voluntary.
For the people in custody.
Correct. Right. And so we do not know across the whole network. If we look at our friends, neighbors, and other states where that is required, we can see as high as 50% in some cases. If you want to talk about those that are actually receiving treatment, so these are folks that are not only symptomatic but have reached a certain degradation of liver function where we're actually treating them, right now we have 102.
Okay.
Now, the concern for me personally on the finance side is about 3 months ago we were at 60. So we're seeing some big increases. And the reason we're seeing big increases is because the drug environment continues to change. At one point, we brought Harvani on, and that was $100,000 per treatment, and it was extraordinarily expensive. And that drug price has now dropped to about $54,000. But we have I'm not sure of the actual name of it, of the new drug, Epclusa. Epclusa is the new one that apparently treats genotype 3. I don't know what those things mean. We're concerned right now because that drug has now come on the market, and because of our constitutional mandate to provide medically necessary care, we are having to provide that. We can't have a system in place where we put some of those costs off. So right now we're treating around 100 in the network.
But the prices are going down.
The prices are going down on Harvani.
On Harvani.
Not on Epclusa. It's still right up there at the top.
And I might chime in, because one of the challenges that DOC has, and that is the challenge, unlike in the public market, where, you know, your doc can actually go to certain other medications. DOC, because of court actions and other, are put in this kind of never-never land of treatment. We've gone through this because often we're asked, why are there certain medications that actually, maybe if you're on the public side, that your docs may not be giving you at lesser price, that yet at DOC they're higher, and it is this actual legal tension that's always out there with DOC. And I need to put that for the record, because we all often get this ask of us from the general public. So I and that adds to the cost of doing business with DOC, just for the record. While we're on the subject of medical cost, I would ask that, and I know I've sent you some information with respect to some work that's being done in Connecticut, where CMS has the one and only in the country nursing home for paroled inmates that would be in DOC. And so what I'd ask that you actually have a meeting with director from OHA as and any other, and as well as Julie, to see how whether Oregon can actually begin having some conversation with CMS, which would help us, and how we can actually, you and I have talked about this over the years, of where maybe some of that 115 or 14 individuals that we have that are over the age of 75 that have medical, serious medical issues, if we've had another way that we can actually deal and treat with them, and maybe this may be an avenue for Oregon. So I would appreciate it if you would get with Director Saxton and others and start exploring that with CMS in Connecticut and find out how they really did it.
Co-Chair Winters, we're happy to do that. Based on the email, I believe folks are already analyzing the information from Connecticut, and a meeting might already be scheduled. Ms. Noberka, we'll make sure that you're added to the invite list. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. The only other thing I'll add to this slide is this tag system is critical for us not only to get it stable, but as we move forward, this is the system that will bear the brunt of the number crunching for any victims restitution legislation that is currently out there. We talk about Senate Bill 844. That is the result of an inmate financial accountability work group. And that work group was chaired and staffed by DOC, included diverse stakeholders, and really it was to develop a system whereby DOC can collect a portion of inmate monies for court-ordered financial obligations such as victims' restitution, compensatory fines.
What's the price tag on Senate Bill 844?
I believe I can speak to the Department of Co-Chair Winters. I believe I can speak to the Department of Corrections, and it's in the neighborhood of $300,000. And that fiscal is the enhancements that are necessary to the system once it becomes stable. So this policy package is just to get the system stable, and then the fiscal on the bill is to provide all of the financial routing to make it possible to separate all of this money out and get it to the right places.
So I'm being asked by Julie, how much to keep it stable?
It's $500,000. So on a statewide basis, DAS is moving forward with a voice over internet protocol or VoIP phone system. And that, unfortunately for us, is unfunded liability. We have to move forward with that project, but we have no funding for it. So we've asked for it here. This is in the neighborhood of $9 million for us and is a one-time expense in 17-19 that helps us complete the project. So the next few slides will cover some of our capital renewal projects that involve replacement of capitalized items across the state for DOC. As a reminder, DAS, the Department of Administrative Services, contracted with Faithful and Gould, an organization that went out and assessed all the facilities around the state. So the items I'm going to be covering here came out of those assessments. The first of these are roof replacements. Our facilities have a considerable amount of square footage of roof space, and unfortunately they take a beating. If you look at the east side of the state, when we just had the snows that we had out there, we were in a position where we had to vacate our pharmacy, we had to vacate our warehouse, and we had to actually even end visitation because of concerns with roofs out there. And these were already roads that are at the end of their natural life anyway. So they Faithful and Gould estimated this would be about $12.3 million. This is bond funded, this is other fund, and will impact our institutions in Pendleton, Salem, and Ontario.
So it's bond funding. What's the deferred cost? What's your two things? Prioritized, what is the priority? Are you looking at all of them at once, or do you have a priority schedule?
Co-Chair Winters, yes, we do have them prioritized. We actually have a list of $140 million worth of projects that are necessary across the state. That was then whittled down to just 32 for this biennium alone, which required us to prioritize across the system. And these are the ones that are in the worst shape.
And debt service cost? Your debt service? If you're going to bond, what's the debt service?
Yeah, Senator Co-Chair Winters, the bonding, I mean, for the department in general, our debt service runs $116 million for the Department of Corrections because we are still paying the debt on all of the buildings that were built over the last 20 years. We currently have about $500 million in outstanding debt at the Department of Corrections, but it was for those construction items. Typically, this is six-year money, six-year limitation, but these projects are typically done in about 3 years.
But still, isn't there a debt service to it?
Oh, absolutely. There is a debt service component to this. Yeah, there absolutely is. I don't have the actual number for that, but I'm happy to get it to you.
Give it to Julie.
Oh. Okay, Co-Chair Winters, Mr. Ball has helped me out here, and it looks like it's about a little less than $1.1 million for 17-19.
Okay.
Yeah.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Huffman.
Thank you. Was this part of the governor's presentation that Jean Gabriel had Friday for capital construction subcommittee that was part of the governor's bonding package?
Yeah, Co-Chair Winters, Representative Huffman, yes, it was.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. The next capital renewal project involves a replacement of HVAC and electrical systems in eight of our facilities, the total cost of which is $12.2 million. If you look at the picture here on the top right of this slide, this is the main view of a condenser and compressor unit at our Columbia River facility up in Portland. These original units, I guess, utilize R22 refrigerant and need replacement when compressors burn out. R22 is no longer cost effective, and the EPA is now no longer recommending that R22 be used. So as we move forward here, Columbia River alone has 15 of these air handlers, and only three of them have been replaced. So this money is going towards the replacement of the other 12, as well as the other projects that we've got going on here. There's also a picture here at our OSCI facility of a steam to liquid heat exchanger that is in pretty sorry shape. Last in the area of capital renewal, we have a number of security systems that need replacement. For those of you that have been to our facility, our Two Rivers facility in Umatilla, you may remember that they actually have bio hand scanners to access secure areas of the facility, and those are beginning to fail and need replacement. We also see the picture on the right here. You can see at our Shutter Creek facility, we've got gate control systems and gate control motors that are starting to fail, as well as we do have some camera systems that are going to need some replacement at both Two Rivers and at Snake River as well. So the total of these projects equals $3.9 million, again bonded. And then with all of these projects, there's always a small amount of project staffing that's a part of this, as well as the cost of issuance of the bonds. So as we talk about some of the things that have not made it into our budget right now, the first I'd like to talk about has to do with specifically what I was just talking about, which is the fact that traditionally at the Department of Corrections, our capital projects and capitalized projects, I guess, were dealt with certificates of participation, or COPs. COPs, we were able to actually move forward and work on asset-based projects, but we were also able to do maintenance and repairs with that money. But now as an agency, we're using Article 11 Q bonds. And Q bonds, when the state goes out on the market and sells bonds, they have to be backed by an asset of some kind. We can't just put maintenance and repairs against those sales. So for the department, we have lost our funding for doing those smaller repairs and maintenance projects. And for us, it's currently not in our budget. So we bring that up just to let you know, A, that at some point we'd like that to be a consideration, but B, it's going to force us over the course of this next biennium to come back to emergency boards or the interim joint committee and talk about the fact that we've had to invest general fund in some of these things and that we will potentially need some backfill. So that's the portion that I was going to cover for you today, but I'll hand it off to Director Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Robbins, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. I'll talk next about a subject you've all heard us talk about before, and it's the Prison Rape Elimination Act. That's an act Congress passed in 2003, and in 2012, they actually had the standards settled and rolled out. This is something that Oregon has embraced from the very beginning. This is about safe and secure facilities. This is about safe adults in custody and safe staff. So with the requirements of the act meant that we have had to manage the coordination of audits. So all of our facilities have been audited. We also have agreed to external audits. So we can't audit ourselves. So we actually participate in a Western region audit circulation, and county partners also have required our assistance as it relates to audits. We coordinate the investigation of all Prison Rape Elimination Act allegations, including assuring there's absolutely no retaliation against an adult in custody who comes forward. And we now liaison with sexual assault victim advocacy groups in the community so that the adults in our custody actually have access to a victim assistance person should they be a victim while in our care and custody. And then, of course, we've had to train all of our staff on the standards as it relates to the Prison Rape Elimination Act. The funding request originally was for three positions to do all of this in the amount of $678,000. Plus, we have identified areas where increased camera coverage would improve our ability to prevent assaults in the first place. Another topic that comes up every time we meet as a group or individually in your offices, and that's staff wellness. You know it's our top initiative and something that is so critical to our agency. Last biennium, thank you, we received 33 positions from you to help eliminate our overtime by increasing our post-relief factor. We know that overtime for our staff is literally a killer, and so we are grateful for those positions. That was actually done after a security analysis of the Association of State Correctional Administrators, who came and looked at our system at large. They recommended those 33 positions for the increase in our post-relief factor. They also recommended 67 positions, which actually would be new posts, new places to have a warm body where we do not have that now, which would, of course, create a safer and less stressful environment. So this wellness package proposed funding for those 67 positions, plus an additional body to become the centralized wellness coordinator. Right now, we have individuals managing those roles within their current duties. When we last met, we talked about the October 2016 prison population forecast. And so since we've last met, we now have the April 1 forecast. And you can see this slide. While it's very detailed, it has lots of information in it. It shows the population projection for the male population over a 10-year period. Now, this hasn't changed much since the October forecast. The current male forecast estimates that in 10 years, there will be 13,928 male inmates. That's a growth of about 4.3% over that 10-year period. And while not much has changed since we last met, I do want to point out one difference. The April forecast will require us to open additional capacity at Shutter Creek Correctional Facility in this biennium. By May of 2018, we will open 50 beds at Shutter Creek Correctional Institution for men. Now, as you...
Just a second, Senator Steiner-Haywood.
I think I know the answer to this because it won't change anything, but so by May of 2018 or 2019, did you say?
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Steiner-Haywood, May of 2018.
Okay, so any changes that we implement in short-term transition leave or any of those things will not have any effect on that prediction because it really won't come into play until after that because it's only for prospective sentences.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Steiner-Haywood, great point. The April forecast is completed based on current law. So if new legislation is passed and short-term transitional leave is increased or the Family Sentencing Alternative Program is expanded, then the next forecast would reflect those law changes. So that this is based on 2 days' law.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. So do you have a way of looking at what's being proposed, and I can tell you that 935 is going to get taken down to 120 days instead of 180 days, which is the vehicle that's likely to move for short-term transitional leave. But there's the FSAP bill, and there's that one. Do you have a way to anticipate at all what those changes might result in, what those bills, if we pass those bills, what those might result in?
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Steiner-Haywood, that's not analysis that we engage in at the Department of Corrections. We help provide information to the Criminal Justice Commission, okay, who does those projections, and then ultimately, once it becomes current law, it's DAS's Office of Economic Analysis that will incorporate those law changes into the next forecast. So that is some data that we could get to you, Senator, through the Criminal Justice Commission, and we're happy to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Senator, I believe that CJC did provide some analysis with the public safety work group that's in that, based on if we did trans leave at 120, 180,
correct,
what have you. So okay, it is in that document.
I'll go back and look at that. Thank you, Senator. Too many pieces of paper.
I agree.
Continue. So I can't leave the slide without pointing out that justice reinvestment is working. 3194 did make change. You've heard me say this again. This slide reflects that. Pre-3194, Deer Ridge would have been fully opened in March of 2015. Shutter Creek would have been fully opened in March of 2016. And last month, you all would have been invited to a ribbon-cutting ceremony down in Junction City where that prison would have been opened. So 3194 has impacted the trajectory at the Department of Corrections.
So 3194 has impacted the opening of three.
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Steiner-Haywood, that is
correct. I think you mentioned three.
That is correct. It has prevented the opening of additional prison beds at three sites. So additional prison beds in Madras at Deer Ridge, where that would have been fully operational. The additional 100 beds that are already constructed at Shutter Creek but sitting empty would be full, and Junction City would have opened last month.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So
you can see that we have still in this forecast pushed Junction City out outside of the 10-year window. So I do not have to ask for additional funding for that prison at this time. The female population forecast. Like the male forecast, the April forecast for women only changed slightly from October to April. As a reminder, you've heard me say this before, we've always recommended the activation of OSPM when the female population reaches 1,280 women. The current forecast projects the women's population now to remain above 1,280 for the entire 10-year forecast. The capacity issue at Coffee Creek is not new. We've been speaking to you about this since the fall of 2015. Our first request to the e-board to open OSPM was in the spring of 2016, and we have been over the threshold of opening OSPM for a year since May 18th of 2016. We've utilized more temporary emergency beds than I said we would. We're at 122 at Coffee Creek, and this not only puts stress on the adults in our custody, our staff, it also puts stress on our structures that were only designed to flush so many toilets and run so many showers, and it also prevents our ability to manage an actual emergency should one occur. I will share a story with you since we've been hovering over the population around 1,300, and I know we've been talking a lot about releasing the pressures at Coffee Creek. For those of you that don't know, I visit two prisons every month for a full-day site visit and meet with the executive team, frontline staff members, and the adults in our custody. And this last 2 weeks ago, I was at Oregon State Correctional Institution, and one of the questions I asked the adults in custody when I'd meet with them one-on-one is, I'm meeting with legislators a lot. What is it that you would like me to share with them? And I was surprised that consistently they said, please talk to them about our temporary and emergency beds. Because we're on these units in beds that are out of sight, out of view from staff. And we know if something bad happens, we're on our own. That staff aren't going to be able to protect us the way they should. So of all the litany of things that I get grieved on, often from the adults in our custody, I was surprised there was a consistent theme. And I wanted to share that with you. So it's not just staff that are concerned. But when we talk about releasing the pressure at Coffee Creek, I would be remiss if I didn't mention the temporary emergency beds in our male population. We've been talking a lot about the female population because we're on that razor's edge of opening an entire new prison, but we're also on the razor's edge with our male population. We have a total of 880 beds. Temporary and emergency beds scattered throughout our male prisons. So when we look for that release, we have continued to engage in conversations and partner with counties to provide work release and reentry programs. And I will give a shout out to our county partners who have really been great partners. They've come forward and said, we want to help. We understand that this isn't just a Department of Corrections issue. The Marion County program is up and running. We currently have 15 women participating in that work release program. The Lane County program is technically up and running. The contract was modified, and Lane County has reviewed the list of eligible women and selected women they feel are a good fit for their program, and they will begin to move into the program in June on the date in which these women become available. We are close to completing a contract with Jackson County. The county was considering accepting women from Klamath and Josephine, but they have decided to just focus on Jackson. So we're getting ready to solidify that contract. We estimate we may be able to fill 3 to 5 beds in Jackson County.
The same question, and I'm sure we can ask CJC, but there is pending there's legislation that is being discussed around this building from the public safety work group, and I'd ask you to take a look at it and confer with CJC of the impact that would have on the bed, of lowering the bed capacity, both for the women as well as the men.
Madam Co-Chair, thank you. We've been paying attention to that group very closely and have looked at the draft report, and I know the Criminal Justice Commission has looked at those impacts. So we're involved in those communications and looking forward to seeing what passes. There's also been, as we look at a release valve, if you will, for our female population, conversations around housing individuals in non-program beds. For example, Multnomah County has brought a proposal together to help us eliminate the temporary and emergency beds at Coffee Creek. But as most prisons and jails operate, it is most cost effective to operate an entire unit at full capacity. And Multnomah County is no exception. So the proposal they put forward, if we were to utilize beds, they are proposing that we would occupy an entire 50-bed unit. So these conversations are ongoing, and I would like to publicly thank Sheriff Reese and his team's willingness to help us work with a solution. In addition, we'd like to publicly thank Scott Taylor, the Community Corrections Director, and his team who have joined the discussions as well. So these conversations will continue, and we'll keep you updated on those conversations. As our budget committee, it is important for us all to remember that these programs are not free. So while they are helping us manage the overpopulation at Coffee Creek, we are constantly monitoring the number of women in our care and custody and the number of work release beds we have in order to ensure we hover around that 1,280 number. And to date, we've been able to keep our women's population manageable with the contracts we have in place. But we are very cautious not to over-contract for beds, since funding for these beds is not in our budget, and it is more cost-effective to house them at Coffee Creek. So it's been a very difficult balance. That balance also comes with some risk. As I said just moments ago, we have 122 temporary and emergency beds at Coffee Creek. So Mr. Robbins pointed out that I did want to provide an update on the Oregon State Penitentiary minimum. There are five of our current projects that we're working on at the facility in preparation for potentially opening that prison. The legislature did give us monies to begin preparing that facility for opening. Now, knowing that we may not open that facility, we committed to you to only spend those monies on projects that the facility needed to maintain its structural integrity. And so one of those was a roof replacement. The roof over the main structure had degraded to such a level that it was actually damaging the structure of the building, and so we're replacing it. We are in the early stages of construction and estimate that that project be completed by the end of June. We recently found issues with the sanitary sewer in the kitchen area, and this is a chronic problem that we're finding in our older facilities statewide. One of the main issues is old cast iron pipes closing up because of rust and debris. So when we started pulling out the old pipe, we found asbestos. And so we're about 30% complete with that project, again, hoping to be finished by late June. Paving improvements. So we still have people utilizing that facility, parking in the parking lots, walking into the facilities, and those areas need to be safe. We've spoken previously to you about the need to replace the facility's parking lot. We have had a number of challenges with outside storm drains, and because of the weather we've been having, the lot really degraded to a point where it's basically gravel and not safe to walk on. So we included that in this vein, and we are in the process of awarding a construction contract. That too should be completed by June 30th. You're seeing a theme here of these projects being done by the end of the biennium. The showers in the facility. So why would we need to fix showers if we don't have any?
Are they ADA compliant?
Madam Co-Chair, I do not know the answer to that question, but I will find out for you.
As you, and even though some of the things that you're doing, and in doing so, I would think that you might want to make certain that things are ADA compliant. I'll talk to Robbins offline.
Great. Madam Co-Chair,
if I can fix a parking lot, then I can actually think about the internal building just in case we might need it for something else that I've got in my plan.
And I can't imagine, Madam Co-Chair, that
you can't imagine
about the geriatric
what it is.
Population inside the Oregon Department of Corrections. So why
goes along with Connecticut?
Why fix the degrading showers when you don't have women showering in them? We still have to go in and turn those showers on. We still have to go in and flush the toilets, run the sinks, or they will deteriorate in a way that will have to be complete replacement.
Just thinking ahead of Connecticut.
I hear you loud and clear, Madam Co-Chair. So we have changed the tile and placed an epoxy-based resin in the shower, which wears 100 times better. So that project is now complete. And the last project is different from the other four in that it is the only one that is not necessarily because of age or weather damage, because a lot of the camera systems in the facility are so old they need replacing. Along with that is the programming controls for the cameras and doors. We are finishing installing most of the cameras, and the contract for programming will be issued in May, and that too should be completed by the end of the biennium.
I need to clarify Connecticut for the panel, and I will send you a copy of the announcement that I received, and I've sent it to the director. States have across this country have been wrestling with the whole cost of particularly the health care costs and geriatrics, and not knowing that CMS has approved one state. And so, you know, I'm quite interested in the how they did it and whether CMS will actually look to other states in dealing with not only that population. And for if they do, it then puts us to where we're bearing 100% of the cost. It would be 50-50. So that's the reason for this conversation about Connecticut. I'm very interested in how Connecticut was able to get CMS to agree to allow Medicaid for this population that, you know, traditionally we've had. Yeah, so with that
Thank you, Director. Madam Co-Chair.
I just needed to clarify why I'm having this dialogue with you on that issue.
And Madam Co-Chair, you and I have spent lots of hours talking about this, and we've done quite a bit of legal analysis. I'm very curious how they've pulled this off. I look forward to getting the answer, because the federal law is very clear that when you are a prisoner, you may not have access to Medicare or Medicaid. It's actually called out in the Act. So how they've maneuvered this, I do not know, but we look forward to learning. Thank you. Okay, this title says OSPM. That is inaccurate. Oh, great. Yours has been fixed. Mine has not. That's good. It's supposed to say Behavioral Health Services. Thank you, Mr. Robbins. I'll turn our attention to health services. And before I go into health care costs here in a bit, I do want to address the recent attention towards our behavioral health unit, which many of you visited, and our work with Disability Rights Oregon. I hope you have seen the recent press coverage and the email I sent to you regarding Disability Rights Oregon's year in review, but I want to provide some background. The Department of Corrections has had a long-standing collaborative relationship with Disability Rights Oregon. For many years, we've had an MOU that includes DOC granting Disability Rights Oregon access to our facilities, our records, and our staff. DOC takes DRO's investigation and progress report very seriously. While we have some disagreements to its contents, we are committed to improving our management of and the provisions of services and treatments to the adults in our custody. And I believe that we've made great change and are pointing our change in the right direction. Based on the memorandum of understanding, we have committed to changes that will ultimately allow individuals who are assigned to the BHU significantly more out-of-cell time, both for structured time in terms of programming and treatment, and that's in the amount of 10 hours, and then our goal is another 10 hours per week for out-of-cell unstructured activities. Now, these improvements are going to require us to make some architectural, operational, and staffing changes. And to date, we have transitioned the intermediate care housing unit to provide needed improvements to our BHU. And this has improved the therapeutic environment for those in ICH, which you all visited that unit at the Oregon State Penitentiary. It's much brighter. You can see the paint, the sunshine coming in. And we've changed the daily schedule for the adults in custody to improve for out-of-time cell. We have also made some improvements to BHU. For example, we removed the window louvers from the inside recreation area, which brought in a whole lot more sunshine. We're not sure why we put them up in the first place. Once you took them down, it seemed a very obvious move. We brought in new recreation equipment. We are providing musical instruments, and we've expanded the unit library. But we recognize that we've got more work to do, and we are committed to fulfilling all the agreements we made in the MOU. We're meeting with Disability Rights Oregon regularly, and I really want to thank you for your support. We will be putting a modular building in to accommodate the agreed upon 20 hours of out-of-cell time, so they'll actually leave their unit, leave that building, walk on the yard, and go to a more normalized treatment modular building. So we're really looking forward to getting that on the ground.
Co-Chair Stark.
Okay. I know Superintendent Kelly talked to many of you about that on site.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Important question here. When talking about behavioral health and those who need that, why would you put a picture of this group?
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, not for the reasons you're joking, that is for sure. I think we just had a whole bunch of words on the slide, and I said, what about that great picture that you took while they were on the inmate transport bus? If they're getting tired during my presentation, maybe they'll
Eight
wake up at this point.
Thinking
if you put
that
it
you
in.
Were going to lock us up.
And it worked. Well, I've told you, Madam Co-Chair, it's easy to go to prison. It's oftentimes hard to get out. We're glad you all got out. And I really do appreciate you visiting.
We missed you, Huffman.
What did you say?
I was letting John know we missed him.
No, then she would have actually been referring to the behavioral aspect.
So,
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative. Senator, I'm sorry, Senator
right.
Fredericks.
I really appreciated the tour.
I want to make sure, though, that we are not overestimating the impact of what I saw. I am truly concerned about calling some of the things that I saw therapy. We had a couple of rooms, that were a little small room that we went into that had a chair that was set up in a closet, basically, is what it was, to try to supposedly work with folks who were struggling with mental health and behavioral health issues. That is, at least there was something, but it was certainly not therapy issues. I mean, that was not therapy, that was effective therapy. It was control, but it really wasn't therapy. And I think we need to begin to understand what it is that we can really have an effect on the mental health issues in the facility and with the people who are there. So while I applaud the effort and the changes that have taken place, considering that I saw it about 6 years ago, and this time I didn't want to run out of the building. The last time I did, I ran, and so did everyone else. We ran away from the building as quickly as possible. We still are not at all adequate in terms of dealing with mental health issues, and we need to recognize that we have a huge percentage of the population there that's dealing with mental health issues, and we need to start really understanding what we can do to really be effective. So I just wanted to make sure that that point is not lost in there. Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Frederick, if I may respond, I cannot argue with any of your comments. I appreciate you keeping us honest. I think we feel the same way. It's pointing the situation in the right direction. It's not perfect. I think if we were to start at ground zero and realize that we were the largest mental health provider in the state, which we were not supposed to become, but we have become, our facilities would look very different. They would be more normalized treatment environments. They would look more like the new facilities at the Oregon Youth Authority, where you have a much smaller normalized treatment environment of 25 individuals, not 564 on E block. And so I think you're absolutely right. We are trying to do the best we can with the structures that we've been given, but we will continue to push the dial, and we appreciate you visiting, you keeping us honest, and I'm glad you didn't want to run away this time.
Well, I didn't say I didn't want to run away completely. I just didn't run away at that particular time. Let me just, one other quick thing, if you don't mind.
Just quickly, because I plan to get them finished by 4:30.
What I saw the last time I was there was not at ground zero. It was actually you were coming out of a hole, because this was not effective. We need to. I'd really like to have a sense from you, and from your team, on what you'd like to see happen. Thank you.
I need to comment because we're putting a challenge on the director. Don't get me wrong. But the biggest challenge is this body.
Yes, that's true.
I've been out to DOC, particularly OSP, probably a lot often than most of you on this panel, except for maybe Representative Sanchez. To see the groundwork and the work that's been done by the department and their staff. In recognizing this particular issue, has been commendable. One of the questions I was going to ask as to, looking at the public safety system across this country and how we have treated this particular population, I think no one has anything to be very proud about. And having said that, I have to say that the work that I've seen the staff and the director and others to try to change inside of DOC, which is very hard when you're talking about, on the one hand, this as a society, we have not moved to the point of where we, one, recognize the issue totally, and two, particularly how it actually involves itself with the criminal justice system. So I have to say that because we have others listening in, and I don't want anyone to think that our department has not attempted to move to do what they can. But if you visit that building out on State Street, I actually say to myself, not only for this population, but for the other population, I am waiting for the day that when we can mothball that facility out on State Street. If I go and I look over in Ontario and new facilities that have been built, and I often talk about sight and sound and all of this and how different the architect is and what have you, and for staffing that are in that, it's a much different feel and architecture for all. So I need to put that out there because I don't want the public who listens to us to think that our department has not actually worked. But this body here has always the challenge of how they actually provide the resources to that branch in order to keep their systems going. And whether it took us light years to actually do the job out there on Center Street. Right. Took an awful lot of push by some individuals on this body with the leadership of Senator Courtney and some others, and those of us who have been interested in changing how we deal with mental illness in this state. So I'm hoping that eventually that it'll also be a part of the public safety system. I can recall when Governor Kulongoski and the work groups, when he was in, that we worked of trying to figure out of how we were going to change not only what happens in our institution, but our communities as well, and providing those resources. See, you've hit a nerve for me, as most of you know, because I've been working on some of this for so long, that our communities are be able to embrace this particular issue, and where we actually are a lot more respectful. You know, for some of us, we actually believe that they don't belong in jails, and I know that my good friend down there that's been he too has some of these same thoughts, but it does go to a cultural thing of us in this society. So I'm sorry if I got off, but so go ahead, Director Pierce.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you, Senator Frederick, for your comments. I appreciate them very much. Back to health services. So you did hear in great detail from health services during phase one, but we did want to talk about the services we provide, our healthcare costs, and some of our current projects. Today's focus is really on the things we've done to bend the cost curve at your request. So I would like to call your attention, and I mentioned to it earlier when I introduced Mr. Robbins, to the Senate Bill 843 work group. The 2013 public safety reform legislation created this work group to address rising health care costs within the Department of Corrections and to really recommend legislation to significantly lower our health care costs. The work group was represented by bipartisan membership from the House and the Senate, the directors or designees of the Department of Corrections, the Oregon Health Authority, Oregon Youth Authority, and we also had individuals who worked in health care and a member of our labor organization, and we also had a county sheriff and a DA. And overall, the work group found, and we really peeled back the onion and looked at all of our books and all of our processes and how we're managing health care, and we found that we were already doing many things that the work group suggested, and we were working on others. So we've provided the work group's report in your appendix for your review, but I'd be happy to answer any additional questions you have around that work. Essentially, what the work group was able to determine is that the healthcare system inside the Department of Corrections was actually running more cost-effectively than what we're running in the community. So, as stewards of your general dollar funds, health services still is continuing post that work group to find ways to save dollars by means of smart procurement or by adjusting our operational processes to save money. There are several outside factors that we always want to stay in front of to operate inside our budget. And some of these outside factors include pharmaceutical cost increases. Our life flights can cost us a tremendous amount for one incident. Our off-site care, dialysis, chemotherapy, high medical inflation rates, and et cetera. So those are some of our cost-saving initiatives.
Senator Steiner Haywood.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Peters, medical inflation rates. So we've charged our coordinated care organizations with keeping their inflation rate at 3.4% or below, and in fact, my subcommittee co-chair and I plan to take that down a little bit in the next biennium. So what are some of your internal and external limitations to keeping your medical inflation rate at a similar level?
Co-chair Winters, Senator Steiner Haywood, probably the biggest driver for us, as Senator Winters referred to earlier, is the fact that we are operating under a constitutional mandate.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have the capability. It's actually unconstitutional for us, with respect to the Eighth Amendment, to actually look at a specific type of illness and say we're going to treat this across the board in this one way.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take level steps to slowly get out of the treatment in other areas. So if you look at the case law, we literally, the words "without respect to cost" is in there. And so that's one of the real problems for us in the department, is even as we look at ways of prevention and things like that, once we've hit the point where we're actually providing treatment, we really don't have an option to belay those costs one way or another. I would say that's probably the largest issue for us.
Thank you. Okay, I get that, but a preferred drug list is not just with regard to cost, because you're still going to put effective drugs on there, right? And you can recommend, you can have a formulary, right? And you can have step therapy even in that context, right? If you're providing appropriate care, you don't have to automatically go to whatever the third drug is up the ladder. Do you?
Co-Chair Winters, Senator Steiner Haywood, absolutely correct. We do have a formulary in place. Our formulary is unique when you look across governmental bodies, because part of what we have to consider in our formulary is its value on the market, if you will, inside the system, addiction issues. And so many times we're choosing drugs that may actually cost a little bit more in some cases because they don't have addictive qualities to them.
Sure, but the vast majority of your, that doesn't apply to treatment for hypertension or diabetes,
yes,
or asthma or any of a host of other conditions where the drugs aren't relevant.
Yep.
I mean, of course, you're going to have to use some different formulations or different choices in this context.
Coach,
you're not allowed to use, for example, the rank list put forward by the Health Evidence Review Commission, even if you were to go as far down the list as you had to and keep treating. You couldn't treat things in that order, even if you didn't cut the list off the way we do for OHA, for OHP. You couldn't use that list to prioritize?
No.
Why not?
It does go back to what he said, and we've tried this once before, and it goes back to that list is unique, as you know, to the Oregon Health Plan.
Understood.
That the statute that he's referring to talks about the offering of care and services for your community or your broader population. The Oregon Health Plan, those lists are really focused totally on that population. And so that is, they're not, they can't use the same guides that we got the waiver for,
mm-hmm,
to do their population that we've done with the Oregon Health Care population.
And that's based on federal law or state law?
Co-Chair Winters, Senator Slater here, it's federal.
And not only was it the federal law, but there's been court cases surrounding this particular issue. It's not as though this is not an issue that has not been challenged, because it has. And so that much I do know about it, that it is a court issue.
Be interesting. I mean, I'm just thinking off the top of my head here, but it'd be interesting to think about whether if you said, can we use this list and just not cut it off? So you'd still have the option of providing services all the way down, just like anybody on commercial insurance. And in fact, I, as a commercially insured person, don't have access to anything I want because I have my insurance company's going to say, no, that's not evidence-based. We're not going to do it. It's not proven treatment. So
Madam,
I realize this is a more complicated conversation can have here, but I'd be interested in having a further conversation with you about
it. And what I would say, and I wish I had the numbers memorized, Madam Co-Chair and Senator Steiner Haywood, is when we looked at the money that we were spending. So the legal term of art that Senator Winters is referring to is a community standard of care. So the federal law and case law has said that we must provide a community standard of care. And you know, where you draw the line for the health plan isn't that. And so when we looked at the numbers with Senate Bill 843 with that work group, don't quote me on the numbers, but it was something to the effect of the average American citizen were incurring over $700 a month in health care costs. In prison, at the Department of Corrections in Oregon, even though we have individuals who are very unhealthy, who are 10 years older biologically than their chronological age, we're actually providing that community standard of care for just over $500 a month.
Okay.
And so the
that's helpful. Thank you.
You're
appreciate
welcome.
That.
Thank you.
But I do want to understand that there is this distinction between what you can require under waiver under the Oregon Health Plan and what you can do in DOC.
I understand. It's just it's an area I'm still learning about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And now I'll talk a little bit about some of the future cost-saving initiatives that we are focused on. We are currently developing a telehealth program to address provider shortages in rural areas. We have already purchased the equipment. We have the telemedicine cart in each institution, and we expect to roll out the program in the beginning of the biennium. We have two warehouses of medical supplies, one on the east side of the state and one on the west. Currently, we order everything we need, the supplier ships it to us, and then when an institution needs something, we box it up and ship it out to them. Our future state is we're talking to our distributor around if we can do a prepay of everything we need, and the institutions can order directly from the distributor, making us more efficient and timely. Plus, with the prepay, as we're talking to this distributor, we would actually get a 1% rebate if we moved in this direction. So that looks like a great potential too. Like the rest of the state, we have difficulty recruiting in the medical profession. So and it's certainly hard in Eastern Oregon where many of our prisons are located. So we have hired a professional medical recruiter, which should help us in filling these health services positions that have been difficult to fill, and we hope that by doing that, we anticipate reducing contractor costs. WASP is an electronic assessment management tool, and this is something we're looking at implementing, which will actually give us better inventory management and cost control for our medical equipment. It is something we haven't ever used before in health services, and so while the cost savings are unknown, we believe very strongly that there will be cost savings associated with moving in that direction. We are also looking at changing the process so that all requests for medical equipments for individuals go through a therapeutic level of care committee where there's a group of individuals who really make that assessment. So we hope that that will allow for more data-informed purchasing decisions, more consistency in what we're purchasing for those adults in custody, and most definitely better record keeping. Now, as we look forward, stepping kind of up and out of health services, I want to share some of the things we will be engaging in, regardless of the budget, during the next biennium. We continue to implement our performance-based management system. I just think that is essential to transparency, to cost effectiveness, to efficiencies. So we're continuing to cascade this out to all of our work sites in an effort to become more efficient, more transparent, more accountable to ourselves, more accountable to all of you. And as the next step, I shared during phase one that we have developed a 10-year plan called Destination 2026 and projects to get us to that 10-year plan. One of the initiatives that we're very excited about is optimizing the use of special housing beds. I think the work that we're doing around our behavioral health unit at the Oregon State Penitentiary really will have a positive snowball effect on all of our special housing units, on how we think about what their out-of-cell time should be, what programming and treatment should really look like. So we're also focused very closely on our employees, both in staff wellness, which I talked about earlier, but also while recognizing we have some of the hardest working public safety professionals in the business, and you've heard me use these statistics before, 35% of these staff are eligible to retire right now. 54% of these staff can retire in the next 5 years. I will tell you that we've been tracking the number of retirees with the PERS legislation being talked about in this building, in addition to a hiring freeze being issued by the governor through executive order, and you all talking about an extended hiring freeze. Just to give you a couple of data points, in 2015, the monthly average of retirees was 11. In the 8 days following the issuance of the governor's executive order and PERS bills hearings, we had 25 retirees in an 8-day period. So this notion of people leaving en masse is beginning. So making workforce planning one of our top initiatives is clearly going to be our focus over this next biennium. And I think that the folk really focusing on our difficulty around recruiting, retaining, and promoting, that we also want to really work on kind of changing how we view ourselves and changing how society views our profession. So we have a great list of projects that we hope will move us in that direction, including providing world-class training and working really diligently to recruit the best and brightest individuals with a focus on individuals who come with a passion for helping people. So we look forward to sharing those advancements as we move forward. And with that, that ends our presentation for today, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Just a question. What percentage of your residents now come with mental health illnesses?
Madam Co-Chair, over half of the individuals in our care and custody have some form of mental health diagnoses. When you look at the female population, it's disproportionately higher than that. It's closer to 70%.
So given those numbers, the training for your staff, and I'm, because now you're doing your in-house training rather than most of the DPSS do, how much of your training actually are you incorporating that particular population so that your people or your staff understand the issue and how to deal with and how to work with?
Madam Co-Chair, I can get you the exact numbers. I know that it's a substantial part of our basic corrections course, which is the cadet program that you're referring to that used to be within DPSST and is now certified for DPSST but run at home, and also our annual in-service training. So I can get you the number of hours that people are being trained on that. In addition, I'll share the additional training that we've been giving on our behavioral health unit and our involvement in crisis intervention training, which has been instrumental in kind of changing the dynamic on how we actually respond to someone who's acting out, who has mental health issues.
We saw what you're doing at the state at OSP. What is taking place at your other 13 cities?
Madam Co-Chair, as it relates to individuals who are mental health,
yes,
all of that training I just described goes beyond the Oregon State Penitentiary walls. That would be to all of our security staff and our mental health staff at annual in-service training. And, of course, when they come on for new employee orientation, if they're non-security, and our basic corrections course, if they come to us through security. So I'll get all of those numbers and provide those to you. The one thing I did not mention was our work around optimizing special housing as it relates to the work VIRA is doing, and we're very excited about that because, as you know, many of the individuals who act out in our care and custody and end up in some form of special housing have some form of mental illness. And so I think our work with VIRA in looking at all of our special housing populations across the state will also impact this population disproportionately in a good way.
Yes, Representative Barker.
I would just like to say, you know, I've been visiting pretty regular over the last several years, and I've seen a great improvement in the mental health over there, and looking forward to the new buildings that the new building you're putting in out there. And I agree. I mean, that looked like a torture chamber that Senator Frederick was talking about, and it is part of control and all that, but it looks like you're continually moving forward, and it's certainly a lot better than it was. I can remember one time I got over there for a visit, somebody just slashed their wrist, and before we left, they were bringing him back to the same place, sewn up. So I appreciate all the work you're doing there.
And I think it's our hope that, you know, Oregon will actually lead the way. I don't think any of us is satisfied with any status quo, from whether we're talking about our community supports as well as those that must go to one of our facilities. I think, you know, we're finally coming to the place of better understanding. I'm hoping that we come to a place of better understanding than we have in the past.
Madam Co-Chair, thank you. Representative Barker, thank you. I appreciate your comments. You're absolutely right. We do not want to stand still. If in 10 years we are going to become the public safety employer of choice with employees who come to work every day acting in an innovative way, knowing that they can change the lives of those in our care and custody, we've got some work to do. Thank you.
Additional questions?
I'll suspect that you're not going to get there.
What were you saying?
Oh, I just said, but if that's not your expectation, you'll never get there.
Right.
Right. You have to have that clear goal, and it's good that you do, because you can't get somewhere if you don't know where you're going.
But I think it has to be the expectation and the goal of, and I hope I made, of not just DOC. I think that it has to have the goal of our society and those of us who make both the policy decisions as well as the funding decisions.
The funding is huge.
Mm-hmm. Unless, you know, that it's all of those pieces, that's what's going to help change and what will help provide the kind of services that I think we all seek and the kind of housing that we all seek. And I said we had this conversation when Governor Ted convened this big, huge work group that included, you know, all the stakeholders trying to come up with solutions, not only that had to do with the correctional piece, but how do we address it in our communities? And communities are a big piece of this.
Right.
We cannot just say, and I'm the first one that says, we cannot just say it is your responsibility, DOC. It has to be where the community at large begins to assume the responsibility for this particular issue, not including the whole issue that we're working with the courts and the alternatives and what have you. It is a huge conversation that we need to be having across the state. So just my sense.
Well, Madam Co-Chair, I like your 2 cents. And Senator Frederick, you asked before, you know, what is our vision? Where do we want to go? As we look at other prison systems around the globe and look at countries like Norway, we talked about that earlier, they still have prisons that look like the Oregon State Penitentiary, but they have been able to secure 25 individuals on a unit in a more normalized treatment environment. They have 1-to-1 staffing ratios. You don't get to work inside of a prison until you go to an academy for 2 years. I mean, when you talk about funding and funding a system appropriately, having clinicians on site in a way that you would at a hospital for those who are mentally ill. And I think to your point, Senator Winters, I had a colleague of mine, the director of North Dakota, actually visit the system in Norway. And the most compelling thing that she came back with to speak to your notion of it's kind of all of us, including Oregonians, need to understand this, she said what was so compelling for her is it didn't matter who she talked to, if it was her cabbie, a legislator, a corrections officer, or their waitress, when they asked why she was visiting, they all said, oh, we love our prison system because we know they're all coming back to us and we want them to be good neighbors. We'd have to have quite the marketing plan to get there. There's no doubt. I can't imagine me getting that response from anyone driving one of my taxis.
No, the good rep and I have been talking about it for some time.
We had quite a debate yesterday on the floor regarding sending people to private prisons, which I was absolutely opposed to and spoke on it. But so we do have a way to go before the public saying, I love my prison.
Yes.
Frederick.
The other aspect of this is it's not the prisons. We need to find a way to intervene well before anyone gets to the prisons.
Right.
And so that's part of the discussion that we need to understand. And that's changing an attitude that says punishment is the primary way to deal with something like this.
Right.
And that's a difficult thing for us as a culture. But I think it's something we've got to start working towards. So I appreciate the work you're doing.
I
think we have a whole lot more work to do. So thank you.
Yep.
Any other questions or comments? With that, I will announce that we got through the DOC today. So I'm going to be very benevolent.
Uh-oh.
I'm going to be benevolent, so you can have the day off tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
That means y'all don't get to meet my mom, though.
What it is she likes to cancel the days that I would be chairing.
Oh!
No, it's prepping for tomorrow night.
It lets you guys go back on the floor and finally
So with that, you guys can clean your calendar off. So with that, we are adjourned.
Got a speech to
thank you, co-chairs. Thank you, members.
Leave early anyway, so.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's
get my mom
to the North Star.
Did you hear
from Korea? Oh.
Did you hear from Korea?
Oh.